There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This is an election results special because, I was going to say because it takes so long to count the votes. I don't think it necessarily takes any longer to count them. It's just that the counts start later these days. I really wish count started like they used to the moment the polls close at 10 p.m. on a Thursday night, but these things stretch out now over the weekends. So I wanted to get all the results in before I talk to Greg Cook, who's one of the best sophologists in the country, worked for the Labour Party, used to advise Blair and Brown, and he has an amazing knowledge, a detailed knowledge of every constituency in the country and a sharp political antenna. And just a quick health warning on this, it was recorded before the Adrian Schatz by-election. So that result is not known at this point, and we will discuss that in a future podcast. But this is about the 6th of May, what those results mean, and of course, particularly for the Labour Party, really, although of course it's all relative, therefore what it means for the Labour Party can be inferred what it means for the Conservatives, but we do go through that in detail. Before we come on to Greg, and it's a fantastic rundown, by the way, with perhaps some surprising takes. Before we come on to that, I love these emails. And please email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Embarrassing, awkward, or surprising encounters with politicians. This one is incredible. This is from Chris. I won't give his surname just in case. But he says, I thought I'd write in as I have a fairly awkward story about when I met Theresa May back when she was Home Secretary. I was at uni in Derby and I joined the Tories. He says, in brackets, the folly of youth. So perhaps we can see where this story is going to go. He says, I was able to rise a little in the local party to become the elected head of what was then Conservative Future. That's what the Young Conservatives had been rebranded as, I think, in the Corbyn era. And he'd been rose to the heady heights, being deputy head for membership on the executive team. As a result, he says, I was invited to the chairman's dinner every year. It was 2014 or 2015, and Theresa May was the guest of honour. The day of the dinner, we'd all been out canvassing since the early morning. I think we'd even been up to Newark to join the by-election, and I was dead on my feet. With some coffee, I'd managed to get through the day and the meet and greet section of the evening. But as soon as Theresa May stood up to give her address, I felt myself falling asleep with my head resting on the table. Not necessarily a reflection of the quality of the speech, but because, to be honest, I can't now and couldn't then remember a word of it. What I thought was a short and subtle power nap, as I do remember hearing the clapping at the end of the speech, turned out to be quite an obvious sleep in which I was told after I began to snore and was quite obviously positioned in a way where I was sleeping. It's also worth pointing out that although I was not at the head table, I was at table number 2, which put me squarely in her eye line for the entire thing. I was roundly chastised after the thing had finished by a higher up. And although Theresa May was lovely to me in the meet and greet at the start of the evening, as far as I can remember, I wasn't given a farewell. Oh, Chris, we've not all necessarily been there specifically in a room with the Home Secretary and future Prime Minister. But when you've got to sleep, I mean, you can't keep yourself awake in the end, can you? This is your body is out of your control, basically. He says, I'm now no longer a Tory, having dropped out of the party after finishing a degree module on modern British history and researching the actual record of the Tories in government. Wow. I'd now consider myself to be much more on the centre-left. I've certainly become a retrospective fan of New Labour. Wow. I now feel politically homeless and have done for years. I do feel, though, as though I should re-enter the fray and perhaps join Labour. Well, Keir Starmer, if you're listening, there you go. Or indeed any Labour person. Chris, a former Tory, is being won over to the Labour cause. So there you go. Chris, that is a fantastic story. So this started out as a thread about seeing politicians on holiday. But if you've ever fallen asleep in front of a politician or said something stupid in the heat of the moment or just out of sheer panic, or if you have any other embarrassing tale to tell, get in touch, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Now, as I said on the last episode, The political party is returning to the stage, and the timing of these shows and the guests I've picked make it look as if though I had some idea about what was going to happen. On the 24th of May at the Garrick Theatre, I'm joined by Peter Mandelson, former MP for Hartlepool, and Saeed Avarsi. On the 25th of May, Keir Starmer and Andrea Leadsom. That show was sold out. And on the 2nd of June, Jess Phillips and Esther McVeigh. You can get tickets for all those shows, apart from the 25th. And there aren't many tickets left for the others by clicking on the link in the blurb, in the show notes, or just by going to mattford.com/live. Thank you as well. A lot of you have been getting in touch about my new podcast, British Scandal, which I feel bad for saying this, but it's obviously really cool. It's number one in the podcast charts and has been all week, which is really cool. And if you like this show, you'll probably like that. It's myself and Alice Levine, and we go through particular scandals in British history. So there are political elements to that. So if you like this, you may well like that. So I've put a link to that, to the Apple link, but you can get that wherever you get your podcasts. So on to this fantastic briefing with Greg Cook. And what I love about episodes like this is Greg used to brief prime ministers. So this is exactly the sort of detail, put in exactly the same words as Tony Blair and Gordon Brown used to get by the guy that used to give it. And I think that's one of the great thrills of this show, is being able to sit there and go, this is what he would have told the Prime Minister. And this is what people will be telling Keir Starmer. This is what people will be telling Boris Johnson, Nicola Sturgeon, Anas Sawar, and the other leaders of those parties. It is this sort of stuff that they get told. And I think that's one of the great things about this show, is not only do we get reflections from people who've been there and done it, when you're getting the benefit of someone like Greg Cook's expertise and insight in a way that leaders would have done and still do, I just think that's a great thrill. In a way, it's almost like role play. You're like, oh, I feel like I'm the Prime Minister being told this. Now, maybe you don't consume the podcast in that way, but if you have a high-backed green leather chair, then sit in it for this. Dim the lights. I was going to say get a whiskey and a cigar. I'm not sure that's what Prime Ministers have done really since Churchill. But make yourself feel prime ministerial, because this is great. We go through every aspect that you'd want. So we go through it at a nation level, at a party level, and anything else perhaps that we might have missed. So the implications for every party, for Scottish independence, what Hartlepool means, basically everything. And you won't get a better guest than Greg Cook to take you through all this stuff. I began by asking Greg about the results being framed as basically a disaster for Labour and whether that was correct.
I have to say, I'm familiar with the results overall, but I haven't looked at every kind of entrail and every detail as I, in the past might have done by this stage. But I think, I think that is probably a fair assessment. I mean, I think if you look at the benchmarks which people set for the parties before the election, what would be a good and bad result for them? Where the Tories came out was on the whole at the very good end, if not beyond it, in one or two places. It wasn't, there were setbacks for them as well with a couple of the mayoralties where they lost. But overall, it, shows them sort of bestriding the scene, really, at the moment. For Labour, I mean, there were some mitigations. I think the result in Scotland was better than anyone would have anticipated 6 months ago. Even though they lost a couple of seats, I think they've held their own there. The result in Wales was probably much better than most people would have expected. They came within an ace of getting an overall majority for the first time there. So those were both very important pieces of progress. There were the two mayoral gains, one of which was expected, the other one which was not entirely expected, although it was a slight freak of the electoral system, but nevertheless quite impressive to have a Labour mayor in Cambridge and Peterborough. But overall, if you then, if you look beyond that, it's pretty much a disaster, to be honest. I mean, I think personally, looking at these elections over the last year or so, when we knew it was going to be the 2 years worth of local elections combined, I think a lot of us had a lazy assumption that it wasn't going to be that dramatic. We've seen followed in detail these local elections, and most of these councils elect in 3 years out of four. And on the whole, it's the same wards electing the same parties, again and again. We thought, well, 2019 is an aberration, it's out of the way, we're going to get back to normal now. Labour was in the lead in the polls briefly last year. We're going to see, you know, the normal kind of midterm trough opposition parties doing a bit better that we became used to, and probably nothing hugely dramatic is going to happen. Even when the Tories went a bit further ahead in the polls earlier in the year, I think that was the assumption. That was partly because the set of elections which was due to be up this year in 2017, which is mainly the county councils, last time they were elected was in the 2017, the early part of the general election, which people may remember, they were an absolute disaster. I think arguably Labour's worst local elections ever. The Tories were 11 points ahead. And so could almost not fail to do better than that, at least in those elections. So we thought it would be, you know, fairly even. The two big mayoral contests in West Midlands and the Tees Valley would be tough, but Labour wasn't completely out of contention. I think what kind of made us think again, or made me think again about that, was when you got the Hartlepool poll, and then when you got some other polls showing these Tory mayors were going to win on a big scale. And it was a reminder that, you know, this is the first set of local elections which the Tories have fought under Johnson. So if there's going to be any, you know, Johnson halo effect, it was going to make itself felt. And also, you know, why should the big picture be any different than what it was in 2019? And that's what transpired. So basically, you know, the local elections broadly played out, you know, along the lines of the patterns of 2019. But, you know, for Labour, the problem was that they weren't just sort of doing incredibly badly in a few places, you know, the so-called red wall places. But, you know, across the board, they did worse than expected, lost seats in most councils. And even in London, which, you know, there was sort of airy talk about Sadiq Khan winning on the first ballot, when actually his vote share went down quite significantly. And, you know, there were parts of London where there was a quite a significant swing to the Tories. So I think overall, it's a real kind of, you know, wake up call. It's a reminder for Labour in particular of the very abnormal circumstances of the 2019 election. And actually, fundamentally, Labour's obviously changed its leader, but with the pandemic, there's not been a chance for any kind of change in the electoral cycle to have played itself out.
I mean, that's right. It's we're basically where we were in 2019. But as you say, the one big thing that has changed is that Labour has a different leader, and a leader who is very different to his predecessor. It's not as if they chose another Corbynista who's on the hard left, who's kind of... people might fear is pro-Russian or pro-Iran or all this sort of thing. Keir Starmer's a very different prospect. And just in terms of ability, it is different. He is more professional. It's not unreasonable to have presumed that that might have shifted the dial a bit. So why didn't it?
Well, I mean, I'm a believer that, you know, leaders are, you know, the kind of defining factor in politics and electoral outcomes. And, you know, the evidence of the polls would suggest that, you know, Keir's not tearing up any trees, but he's clearly kind of trusted as a leader much more than Jeremy. On the whole, he's an asset. You know, what you get in focus groups is that, you know, people on the whole who switched away from Labour in 2019 feel that Keir's a step back in the direction which they would want. But clearly the circumstances of the last year have been you know, traumatic for everybody, and very difficult for Keir to, you know, establish a message, establish a personality. He's not somebody, you know, his assets aren't naturally that he's kind of a great charismatic performer. He's a very intelligent, solid, decent guy. That's how he comes across, and that's the reality of it, I think. But he's up against a phenomenon, really. I think that's what we can say. And I think Hartlepool is probably the evidence of that there's never been a politician that can be compared with Boris Johnson in his behaviour or in the electoral reach which he had. And, you know, looking back now, we can see that, you know, for example, he managed to win the mayoral election in London, Labour's greatest heartland now, really, in 2012, which was the year that the Tories did worst in local elections against Labour of any year since 1996, and he still managed to be re-elected in London then. So he had that reach. He's got that great asset that whether you agree or disagree with him, you listen to him. And I think what we've seen in these elections is that he cuts through, and to a certain sector of the electorate, they are, you know, very enthusiastic about him. But if you've got, you know, a fairly kind of balanced choice, you've got no particular strong reason to vote for one party or another, then he can be a decisive factor. And I think that's, you know, it's very difficult for any leader up against that. But for Keir, you know, it's just too early for him to have made that much impression.
Particularly during a crisis like this, which is, it's locked down basically the whole planet. There's never been anything like this, really. So, of course, that has political implications. But what does your antenna tell you about what Labour needs to do? Is it just that they need to carry on doing what they're doing, but be louder about it and get on telly more and show Keir off a bit more? Or is there a problem with Labour's political positioning? Do they need to move further to the centre ground?
Well, I mean, it's well known now that, you know, what the 2019 election exposed more than any other one did previously is the new kind of pattern of Labour support. The Labour is a party which is, its heartlands now are the big cosmopolitan cities and their kind of diaspora, professional people, educational people, and it's got them lots of gains. The university cities like Bristol, for example, where the heart of the West of England mayoralty, which Labour gained, they vote in big numbers now for progressive parties for Labour in general elections. The Cambridgeshire and Peterborough result was largely off the back of the kind of outpost of very pro-EU liberal academia in the kind of greater Cambridge area. That's where the anti-Tory trends were the strongest. So there's been big electoral gains for Labour in London's, its profile's transformed over the last 30 years, other big cities. But the generality outside of that is that Labour's drifted further and further away from many of the people who used to be regarded as its core vote. And that's been, that drift's been going on for a long time. The last couple of elections, it's focused into a shift to the Tories. Now, you can argue about whether it's too left, too right, I suppose. I mean, my argument, you know, there's clearly been big demographic change, which has underlined all of this. I think there are political choices which the Labour Party has made, which have been the big staging posts along that route. For example, the last four elections, it has gone into with leaders who were, whatever their assets, Gordon, you know, outstanding statesman and politician, but the fact was that he was less popular than David Cameron, and Labour has chosen its leaders on the basis of what its activists feel most comfortable with. Although, you know, again, let's acknowledge that David Miliband rather than Ed won the members' vote in 2010. But, you know, on the whole, leaders who are closer to the kind of pulse of the party than maybe necessarily they are to the electorate. And there have been other staging posts along the way Brexit was handled and so on, which are important. But all of these, I think, are products of the type of party Labour is now. And, if there was one kind of characteristic that sums it all up, I would say that Labour has become chiefly a party of the public sector. Its members are very disproportionately drawn from that. That gives a particular mentality on issues. You know, for example, it's one of the axioms of Labour now that the root of all evil is austerity, brought in by David Cameron in 2010. And all the cuts which have flowed from that. And clearly those cuts have been devastating in many areas, particularly local government and so on. But I can't remember the last time a Labour spokesperson did anything other than, presented with a problem, suggest that the answer to it was spending more money. And, you know, on the whole, people will support spending more money on services rather than less money. What it's ignoring is the fact that the Tory austerity, as it's called, was not popular with the public, but it was accepted as necessary. And even now, you know, certainly at the time, every focus group I did between 2010 and 2015 for the party, in all different kinds of sorts, amongst all sorts of different kinds of social groups, people on the whole, you know, with a few exceptions, on the whole, people believed that it was necessary to rein in spending. Worse than that, from Labour, they had this view that the need for that was because of what Labour had done and the party, which they felt the nation had had spending under Labour. And that is something which hangs around it. And I think until Labour gets a more nuanced view about, you know, its attitude to what it calls austerity, but, you know, is actually about kind of responsibility with public spending. And clearly with COVID, that's going to become an enormous issue over the next few years. Then I think it's out of tune with the instincts of many of these former voters. The second area, I think, which flows from the public sector angle is that Labour has given up completely on the idea of reform, modernisation of public services. And if there's one thing Labour should be, it should be about making public services the highest quality, the most customer responsive they could possibly be for you know, all of us who pay for them and use them. But now, as I say, the solution is always about spending, and to the extent that there's you know, any discussion of reform, it's usually about sort of ideologically excluding the private sector from any involvement in it. You know, and that's not to say that there aren't, you know, many, there's valid arguments for many of these things, but it's, again, it's not the instinct which most people have about how things should be run. And the result is that, you know, many of these red wall areas where demographic change has been taking place, they've lost all the kind of routes which they were given through, you know, in the coal fields, you know, the community binding of the NUM and the fact that everybody worked in the same industry and so on. That's now ancient history. The you know, Labour's been surviving for many years now on the kind of community tradition and loyalty. And what you find is that when that breaks down and when people find they've got an, you know, an alternative which is actually more attractive, you get the kind of extraordinary results which we've had in the last two elections. And the scariest thing from Labour's point of view, to my mind, is not, you know, just what happened in 2019 with the losses then. It's what happened in the seats which Labour lost in 2017, which, you know, some of you will be familiar with, like Mansfield, northeast Derbyshire, where the dam broke on the Labour tradition. And the water flooded through in 2019. And these are now, you know, most people would objectively say numerically are safe seats. So it's a major, major problem which Labour has to address of how it actually, you know, communicates what its values are and the policies which it builds on that. I you know, my view would be that the what they shouldn't do is to kind of have a red wall project and focus on you know, retail policy offers. What they need to concentrate on is to present themselves as a credible, responsible government for the whole country, which will bring all those areas along with it. And you know, while they can't win an election without those areas, they also can't win an election without places like Milton Keynes and Swindon and you know, the traditional kind of inverted commas Middle England marginal battlegrounds. So that's what they should be concentrating on. That's what Keir, I'm sure, will be trying to present over the next few years.
I totally agree. And I think it's the same for the Tories when they talk about this union unit. We're going to appoint a guy that's going to keep Scotland in the UK. You think, that's not how this works. And in doing that, you're kind of saying, there's a problem. You know, and by definition, you're saying, we need to talk to these people differently. I mean, I know it's hard to do, but I totally agree that the whole thing is talk to everyone. It's not a problem. There's, most people in Britain have something in common. There are huge things that we have. And that's not just about the union and Scotland and England. I mean, you're not going to find two countries on earth that have more in common than Scotland and England and, of course, Wales. So it shouldn't be that hard to say. I mean, particularly after a pandemic that we've all been through together. Obviously, there are differences in the way that people have experienced it in terms of you know, demographics and age and income and all those things and race. But still, it has been a stressful time for all of us. And if you can't bring everyone together on the back of that and see that, in a, you know, it's been a very, very difficult time, but in that sense, it's been very bonding. I don't understand how people think about politics sometimes. I think it's really not that hard to say. If you went to university and you're well off and you live in London, actually, there are loads of things you have in common with a former coal miner in the northeast of England. There are loads of shared interests. Like, those things don't make you totally different people. And if you can't, I mean, any major party should be able to bridge that gap. For some reason, why do Labour find it so hard? Or why is Labour since New Labour found it so hard?
Well, I mean, that's the point. I mean, it has achieved this. I mean, I've this is a story which goes back decades, you know, really, Labour's relationship with the with its working class support. The one very interesting kind of example of that, you know, if I think you could probably make us quite a strong case that the high point of class voting was the 1964 election, when Harold Wilson just sneaked ahead. And probably, the, if you know, if you were able to make these measurements, you'd find that, you know, the constituencies he won all had a kind of manual working class majority. The ones that the Tories won had a white collar majority. That's the point from which everything has changed. Now, the 1970 election, Labour lost unexpectedly. And the worst result in that election was in Cannock Chase, which was the seat of Unairin Bevan's widow, Jenny Lee, which Labour lost on a swing of 10% or more, which was almost unheard of at that time. Now, Cannock Chase is a mining area, still was a mining area at that time in Staffordshire. Right through the last 50 years, it's popped up again and again, you know, as the sort of exemplar of this story. So Labour kind of narrowly regained it in 1974, lost it heavily in 83, narrowly regained it in 92, won it with ease through the new Labour years. And in 2010, the Tories won it from number 205 on their winnable target list. And in, I think, two out of the last three elections, it again has had the biggest, almost the biggest swing in the country. And last week, symbolically, the Tories actually got a majority on the local council for the first time. So, you know, the story of Labour's travails in, you know, industrial areas and mining areas is one which has gone on through the 70s and 80s. You know, your old region, the East Midlands, is one where it's particularly, you know, concentrated numbers of these seats which were affected over that period. And in the 70s and 80s, the big story was about what was called aspiration, which was basically about how all these miners now had tellies and went to Mallorca on holiday. How could you ever expect them to vote Labour again? But indeed they did, and on a big scale in 97 and 2001, when Labour had a big national appeal. It was areas like that which kept the Labour government in 2005, but which have now deserted Labour for the Tories on quite a big scale. Cannock Chase, the Tories got 67% of the vote in the general election in 2019. It's in Labour last week, Labour literally lost every seat that it was contesting. Now it's slightly different, because people talk about these as kind of left behind towns, left behind by globalisation. I'm sure, you know, these things have a meaning, but you have to be very careful that you don't sound patronising, and that, you know, we should all be on the, you know, the conveyor belt towards, you know, middle class nirvana of living in somewhere like I do in Southeast London, where you've got wine bars and coffee bars and, you know, people are living it out on the street, and people can pick and choose when they go into work in the office nowadays. As something which everybody else aspires to, but others aren't able to because they've been left behind. You know, you have to accept that people have different outlooks, different values, and they have pride in their areas. So I think the language which he's talked about is very important as well.
Pride was one of the, I think 2005, that was kind of the word of that campaign. There was the respect agenda, but I remember particularly in the local government elections around that time, it was that whole thing was proud of Hammersmith and Fulham. In fact, I remember the Labour Party broadcast, proud of South Dorset, proud of Gedling, you know, all that.
Yeah.
Labour at that point really understood. And what it was able to do, and again, it's not that hard. These aren't insurmountable things. They're entirely consistent to go. People like where they live, and they want it to improve it. It's not that they think it's perfect, but they want to really like where they live. And that applies on a national level as well. They don't want to feel down about the country. They don't want to feel like we've all gone backwards. That doesn't mean that they don't think there are problems that need sorting out in work poverty, unemployment, racial and other divides. But fundamentally, I think it's that Labour, for basically the last at least 11 years, hasn't really sounded like it likes the place that much. And it doesn't mean that you have to sing Rule Britannia and wave Union Jacks. There's a kind of smell that's given off. And certainly waving the Palestinian flag en masse at a party conference does not send the message that Britain is your first priority. So maybe it's just a simple attitudinal shift.
I think it's also, you know, of its nature, if you're the opposition party, you oppose, that's what you do. You know, and if you're, you know, sitting in Parliament and the Tories are bringing forth a lot of, you know, things that you disagree with, then you're going to kind of present that to the public as these great wicked things which they're doing. And it creates a kind of mood of negativity around, which I think is hard to do. You know, logically, you'd say if, you know, one of the issues for Labour, which is different now from the 80s, is that it needs to get nearly all its extra support from the Tories. You know, there's no centre ground which you can get it from. But logically, you'd say, well, if you want to get switches from a party, actually, you should be cozying up a bit closer to them, you know, because if you insult what they're doing, you're actually implicitly insulting all the people who voted for them and the judgment which they made, and you're relying on a kind of bias remorse. So the balance to strike is very important there as well. The other point about 2005, of course, as well as the points you make, is that on the Tory side, they were running a very sinister campaign there about immigration, with which the are you thinking what we're thinking posters, which was designed to tap into the the views which they thought voters in many of these Labour areas held. But because Labour, you know, was dealing with the immigration and asylum issue, you know, was perceived to have made mistakes, but was also perceived to be addressing it and dealing with it in a governmental way, people trusted Labour to continue with it. And, you know, actually, the swing which remained to the Lib Dems, also to the Tories, was amongst more middle class people over Iraq and other things in that particular election. So it's, you know, and I still think, you know, I think one of the progress that Keir has made is that I suspect, you know, I didn't talk to a huge number of voters, that for those who were turning away from Labour, it wasn't with the kind of, you know, active rejection, which it was in 2019. It was a much more nuanced and balanced decision. And, you know, what all these results show us is the capacity which you have now, when there aren't so many people who have, you know, core tribal loyalties to parties, you can get big swings in short periods of time. Now, it's obviously going to be monumental for Labour to turn it round before the next election, but it's at least, you know, something that's possible.
You mentioned the word progressive earlier to describe Labour and other parties, and I just wonder if, I know the Conservatives are called the Conservative Party, and literally that is the opposite of progressive, but nevertheless, do voters see the Tories as regressive? And actually, if you think of the way perceptions around the pandemic, so take out obviously all the incompetence, and I think a lot of that stuff is judgment deferred, that when you get the other side of COVID, however long that takes, and you have public inquiries, maybe public opinion starts to change a bit and more of the outrage will come. But at the moment, as people are just focusing on getting through this, and that's all they're thinking about, you can see why the vaccine has been a source of huge optimism. But also the furlough scheme. And early on, the government took away a lot of, I mean, there are still, you talk to publicans about the economic problems that they face. It's not like they've solved every economic problem for now, but they at least allayed most people's first fear, actually, was, oh my God, am I going to lose my job? Can I pay the rent? Can I pay the mortgage? That stress was kind of taken away by the government. And I think that was huge. So even though they are the Conservatives and people might perceive that Labour are more progressive, given the last year and a half where Corbyn actually felt really regressive for a lot of people, whether on anti-Semitism or the economy or anything, and then the Tories have paid people's wages and got this vaccine, is it unreasonable to suggest that actually for a lot of people, the Tories might feel a more progressive option?
Yeah, I mean, I'd imagine most people wouldn't see things in terms of, you know, how we would define progressivism. You know, the tendency always would be that, you know, if people were asked to define what the parties are about, that Labour's about looking after poor people and about, you know, more equality. It's about the health service. And still, I suspect now, you know, despite the new kind of sources of support it had, people would still think the Tories are basically for rich people. I think on the pandemic, I mean, my experience, I did a few groups, focus groups through the last year, and there's a core group of people who, you know, probably hate Johnson for pretty much everything he does, who have got a very well rehearsed you know, narrative of where it all went wrong, and they'll kind of acknowledge at the end that the vaccine rollout has been you know, a success, but they still think it's been a disaster, and most but the generality of opinion is that, you know, how could any government have, you know, done much better, and you can understand why they made mistakes. I mean, my suspicion is that, you know, any public inquiry is people are just going to want to move on from it. And it's unlikely, there's unlikely to be kind of a backlash, because that will still be the kind of general mood. I mean, I think that the nature of the Tory government we have at the moment is very, is, you know, whether you describe it as progressive, throwing lots of money around, it's basically a function of Johnson and his the fact that he finds it almost impossible to do anything which he thinks is going to upset anybody. You know, he just likes to be popular, so he'll make wholesale promises of spending or whatever it is, you know, more police, without any kind of particular ideology behind it. I think when push comes to shove, and if the Tories see that there's, you know, an advantage in positioning themselves, you know, in the new kind of post COVID world of public spending restrictions, as sort of saying, well, you know, we'll spend what's necessary, but, you know, at least you can trust us to have an eye on the, you know, on the strength of the public coffers, whereas Labour would just be indiscriminate. I suspect that difference would still, you know, resonate with most people.
Because based on what you said earlier, it seems that the opportunity for Labour coming out of this crisis, and given Johnson's instinct to just splurge to keep his popularity afloat, Labour could potentially position itself as a party that says, this government spending is out of control. A lot of this spending is reckless. And actually, we will be, not austerity, obviously, but we would be far more sensible with the public finances. This government has been wasteful, and flip the argument that way around.
Potentially. And I think definitely Keir would be a credible kind of, and Rachel Reeves would be credible kind of vehicles for that kind of message. But I think the Labour Party would have a long way to go to kind of convince people, but also it would also have to get it out of the mentality of you know, unspecified extra spending in every area. Because if you say that, well, the next question obviously is, well, what would you not spend that the Tories are spending? So, you know, I think that may well be the kind of direction of travel they have to move in towards the next election. A lot depends, of course, on, you know, the reality of the economy and what the Tories themselves do, and whether, you know, there is any kind of splurge, and whether people understand, you know, the Tories got a fairly credible excuse, it seems to me, if people in the red wall pop up in 3 or 4 years' time and say, well, what about all this spending that you promised us, which doesn't seem to have materialised. I don't think many electors think in those terms anyway, but theoretically, if that was the case, well, the Tories could very easily say, well, sorry, you know, we just borrowed £250 billion or whatever it is, keeping you all in work during the pandemic. So I think the game has changed, the ground has changed for all of these issues, and it would be at least a year, I think, until we find out where the parties are differently positioning themselves on it.
And ultimately, that exposes something that I don't think a lot of people in politics don't understand, is if you can make people like you, you can change your argument and they'll go along with you, because they'll go, you know what? I know you promised to spend a load of money around here, but you've told me that you borrowed all the money because of COVID, and I kind of get that. And that doesn't mean I feel betrayed. I get that things have shifted. When they don't like you, they go, oh, that's a broken promise, you terrible lying bastards. So being likable is such an important part of politics. I mean, it's arguably the essence of it is, do I like you or not? And we try and pretend this isn't part of it. And obviously, some of the leaders Labour have chosen are sort of in defiance of that principle. So then how does Keir Starmer make himself more likable than Boris Johnson?
Well, I don't think, you know, I don't think you can present yourself to the public as anything other than you are in this day and age. You know, people, everybody you think of that, you know, is a celebrity of any sort, people feel they have a fairly good grasp of their kind of character, and usually they'll be broadly right. You know, the television is pretty unforgiving to of anybody who tries to repackage themselves artificially. The one thing which I do think Kia probably needs to do is at some point have some kind of declaration that the Labour Party has changed in some way. You know, one of the things which, you know, I think has been absent from the last 11 years, really, is any sense from Labour of acknowledgement that it's been defeated, and that even though it might think it's been right on the arguments, that the public doesn't agree with them. And I think, that all actually kicked off with the very messy way that Labour left power in 2010, trying to hang on in what was clearly a completely untenable scenario by trying to put something together with the Liberal Democrats, and then becoming kind of resentful of the coalition and trying to sort of suggest that it wasn't a legitimate government. All of these were perfectly understandable rhetorical arguments, but what it meant was that Labour at no stage faced up to the fact, the scale of what actually was, you know, I would argue one of its worst defeats in its history in 2010, to go from being a majority to less than 30% of the vote. That has never been acknowledged, and for different reasons. The same really has happened after each election. We had the Scottish debacle in 2015. We had the freak election in 2017 when Labour thought it, you know, felt like it was a moral victory. No point has Labour actually stood back and said, actually, the public don't really like what we've become, or they don't, you know, good proportion of the electorate, including a lot of our ex-voters, are now, you know, they're not, you know, they basically don't support most of the things which we take for granted. And that's going to mean at some stage, I think, that Keir's going to have to say we've actually been wrong about some stuff. Now what that is, the scope of it, I don't know, but I think there has to be a change message. Now, obviously, it'd be trite to call it New Labour, or, you know, that's to try and repeat the trick that was done in the 1990s explicitly by Blair's team when they tried to make people think that Labour was a reinvented party. But there has at least, I think, to be acknowledgement of a different direction, and that Labour is actually listening to what the electorate has been telling it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You mentioned Scotland there, which is really interesting. Just before we come on to Scotland, on London, as you said, I'd seen Twitter, and obviously, believing what you see on Twitter is a fool's game, but there were people saying, oh, it's Sadiq Khan might win it on first preferences. It's like, oh my word. Now, he still won with a very healthy margin of victory, but it was closer than last time. And you got the sense, maybe this was the problem with the expectation management, but it was a bit closer than they would have liked. Is that because Boris had won in London before? So there's probably still a kind of pro-Boris constituency across the city, and having him as the Tory leader and prime minister helped kind of pump up that vote in the way that Theresa May or David Cameron wouldn't have? Or is there something happening there as well? Are the Conservatives making deeper inroads in London?
Well, I mean, I think what it's kind of brought home to us is that you can't, you know, I've probably been guilty of this myself. You kind of think there's some sort of, you know, magic dust over the Greater London area, which
repels Tories,
puts rocket boosters under Labour, and means people hold their nose at the words Tory, and there were a few kind of holdouts in the fringes of East London, but actually that trend was pretty inexorable and was potentially going to engulf Boris himself and Duncan Smith at the next election. You know, we've been reminded that there are still a lot of Tories in London. You know, I think there were fascinating aspects to it. I mean, there's clearly there are a few areas where the Tories have been done permanent damage by Brexit. You know, they've scraped through in the West Central area, which is Westminster and Kensington, with a, you know, huge swing to Labour there. And one can only attribute that to the fact that, you know, these are people who have a huge stake in the EU. They really, you know, Boris has really broken with them on that. You know, and there are other parts of you know, Cambridge and Peterborough mentioned, and others where that's clearly an issue as well. I think I would, if I was Labour, I would also be looking at potentially some, you know, different groups in different parts of London where the trends have not, over the last couple of elections, been quite as rosy as they have elsewhere. You know, one of the areas which Bailey won, which Goldsmith didn't, was Brent and Harrow, and there's a whole big bank of you know, majority Indian origin voters, I think, in North Brent and Harrow, which where the swing wasn't so great last time, you know, and maybe needs to be careful about too much taking for granted, you know, all non-white voters as necessarily being anti-Tory, and there might be trends underlying it there. But the general point is that this was a high point election for the Tories and it affected London to a certain extent. As well, there were enough parts of London, you know, there are swings to the Tories even in, you know, the real kind of progressive heartlands, you know, places like Hackney and Lewisham and places like that. You know, that's the reminder that London isn't kind of sort of immune from everything else, even though the trends remain contrary to what we're seeing in much of the rest of the country.
And if you were Sadiq Khan or you were advising him, what would you do on the back of this result? Would you say, well, we just keep on doing what we're doing? Or do you think, oh, we need to be more visible, or we need to talk about X, Y, or Z more?
Well, I think Sadiq personally is on the whole pretty popular. I think, you know, he needs maybe to get, you know, one or two achievements under his belt. It'd be great if he could get Crossrail actually up and running. Maybe he needs to focus, you know, clearly one of the factors which, you know, appears in popular opinion, at least, which is a problem in London, is the level of crime. You know, maybe he needs to focus his attention a little bit more explicitly on that. You know, he's clearly been doing things on that. You know, maybe slight adjustments in the and perhaps a little bit more strategic focus on achievements and, you know, what he's trying to do.
Let's talk about Scotland.
I don't think it's anything particularly wrong. Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Scotland, because if anything, it's the most fascinating part, and obviously because it has implications for the rest of the UK, and indeed whether the UK can be called the UK in a few years' time. Because of Scotland's system, it makes both sides on the union debate able to claim victory, because it's basically 50-50. But what all sides have to kind of accept is the runaway popularity of the SNP is incredible. And I know that voters know that they've got two ballot papers. So on the second one, you know, that effectively tops up. But on the first past the post segment, on the constituency vote, I think the SNP got something like 38 seats. And then the next party, you're talking 4 or 8. I mean, if that was a Westminster election, and I appreciate that some voters would vote differently because you wouldn't split your vote in the way that you do, but still, and after all this time, and given their record, and I get all the reasons why, but their popularity is something that anyone who's worked for a political party anywhere in the UK really has to marvel at.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got a similar situation to Wales, where Labour is basically turning out the same result with slight differences at the margins, election after election. Scotland has got into the same kind of frame now where the SNP are totally dominant. And obviously the system was set up because of the fear, you know, in the late 1990s that Labour was going to get that kind of domination of the constituency section, which indeed, you know, it did, won the overwhelming majority in the first couple of elections. I mean, my perspective on it is that this ought to be seen as a really quite severe setback for the SNP, that they've, you know, they set this election up as being about whether they individually got the majority as a mandate for a referendum. And let's remember also, this is the first election after Brexit, which was supposed to be the great game changer. You know, lots of very bright people told us that if the UK left the EU, then there'd be a surge in support for Scottish independence. Actually, it's back at, you know, roughly 50-50, probably majority no right at the moment. There was no swing to the SNP to suggest that there's the great desire for a referendum. In fact, the opposite. You know, there was clearly wide-scale tactical voting going on to defeat them, presumably generated by the fact that people didn't want to go through all this again. Sturgeon's own share of the vote fell in her constituency. So it seems to me very cheeky indeed for them to claim a mandate when they failed to do so. And I think it'd be quite legitimate to say no, because we cannot go through, you know, it doesn't just affect Scotland, it's the UK as well. And the benchmark, as I understood it, after the 2014 referendum was that they wouldn't return to this until there was a consistent level of 60% support for independence in the polls, which has never been reached. So the goalposts are moving. And it seems to me utterly reckless and irresponsible to be talking about having a referendum on the future of the UK in the next couple of years, with all the fallout from COVID on public spending and the rest of it, and without that kind of mandate. I think, you know, I suspect if the SNP hadn't put that you know, benchmark down, they probably would have won a majority, because it seems to me that people regard Sturgeon, whether they agree with her or not, as a competent leader. That's the Ashcroft polling showed that. Boris, you know, extraordinarily unpopular. Let's remember, this result is also in the context of an extraordinarily unpopular Tory prime minister in London as well. And they've still failed to get over their own declared threshold. So I think it's a kind of it's a terrible situation Scotland's got into. It's got a government has actually got an active interest in not making the system work and not trying, you know, show no particular interest in actually addressing some of the problems which Scotland has, because it's so fixated on this one issue. And, you know, it seems to me that's only going to shift. You're only going to see that change when, you know, either for whatever reason Sturgeon goes, and I don't see a kind of huge, you know, bank of talent behind her to replace her, or we get back to a situation where Labour is a serious contender for UK government again, and it's not seen as kind of inevitable and necessary to vote for the SNP if you're not a Tory in Scotland. You know, you've got the choice of voting for Labour. That, you know, when we get to that point, then I think, you know, maybe things might shift. I think also this should be a key element of Keir's strategy, because it seems to me, you know, Labour politicians rightly were aghast at the leaving the EU and the implications they had for the economy and jobs and so on. Well, I think there's been a slight kind of case of my enemy's enemy is my friend with the SNP over the last few years. It's not a tenable position to think Labour could ever be in a Westminster arrangement with them in government. We need to see them off. And we should also be completely opposed to their separatist sort of philosophy, as much opposed as we are to the Tories, it seems to me. So I would hope that Keir will focus you know, much more on opposing the SNP and you know, the issues which they're throwing up for the constitution over the next couple of years.
It also gives him an opportunity to put the SNP and the Tories in a basket together and say, wherever you, whether you live in Scotland or England, you've had governments that have done this, this and this. And their handling of the pandemic has been broadly identical. There was no great creative thinking from Nicola Sturgeon. It was Tony Blair's suggestion that everyone get the first dose first that was the game changer, really. That didn't come from anywhere else. Certainly didn't come from within the Scottish government. And whether it's on care homes, on drug deaths, you know, you can, there's a narrative that, Keir Starmer can attack both of them on. Just on the numbers coming out of that election then. So if you add the seats in the Scottish Parliament together, you could say, well, there's a pro-independence majority on the floor of Holyrood, because if you add SNP to the Scottish Greens, who, to be fair to the Scottish Greens, are explicitly pro-independence. Whether that's wise, if you really want to have environmental impact, is another issue. But nevertheless, however, the crucial thing for the SNP is a referendum is a binary choice, and it does not basically exist at a constituency level. And on votes, if you add the votes of the so-called unionist parties together, although I'm sure Labour might balk at that, just in terms of it creates sort of Ulster-like images that Labour might not identify with. But if you add, effectively, the Remain vote up, it is more votes than the Leave vote as it pertains to Scottish politics. So for the SNP, surely for them, yes, they can say we're the most popular party in Scotland. Yes, they can point to the phenomenal results on that first ballot paper. But deep down, as you say, after Brexit, after Boris, after COVID, after Corbyn, they are still behind on the number on their number one priority. They still can't do it. Now, what they might say as well, the sands of opinion are shifting. You know, effectively, the Remain vote in Scotland is dying out. Is that as younger people come into the franchise, they are far more enamoured with Scottish independence. And it will only, in 5 years' time, that will all change. Other people might say, well, the older you get, your perspective shifts, and you shouldn't just see a cohort as having one opinion throughout their life. I don't know what your take on that is.
I think the cohort thing has been just demonstrated to be way too simplistic over decades. For as long as anybody has been studying these things, they've been saying, well, you know, the younger generation is more Labour, and so over the period of time, then more Tories are going to die off and the rest of it. And it doesn't work like that. It's clearly, as people get older, they're, again, this is way too simplistic way to look at it, but people become more conservative with a small c on average, and that compensates for it. It's why the argument about rerunning the Brexit referendum was because of those changes was nonsense. You can do the math, and obviously I'm pretty sure that there was a majority, if they'd chosen to put it, in favour of independence in the last parliament as well. The fact was, we have this kind of funny idea of a mandate, and the SNP set their own mandate, which was to get a majority. And, the answer that come back from the electorate is, no, we're not giving you the majority. So that seems to me to be the simple answer to it. But there's, this Nicola Sturgeon, I get on one level, I kind of admire her because she's clearly a politician of enormous ability. But she's completely shameless in her manipulation of every issue, every kind of event to this one end of getting a referendum and then independence. And it seems to me to be just debilitating for the Scottish political system. And we saw they don't have any, all the scandals that were going on over Salmon and the rest of it over the last few months, not any kind of break in the SNP ranks in Holyrood, nobody able to pipe up and say, hang on, this is wrong. Actually forcing a change in it, because they are so kind of tunnel vision about this one cause which they have.
I wonder if, because Sturgeon is seen as a kind of political colossus in Scotland, but she seems to make a number of strategic errors. One, I think, is the way in which they've used the Brexit debate. I totally get that is a huge opportunity for them, because Scotland voted a different way to the rest of the UK. So, of course, you use it. But in the language they've used to describe the economic consequences of Brexit, in a way, I always think with Sturgeon, she's writing setups for the audience to deliver punchlines, because she says separation causes economic chaos. And then you go, well, so does Scottish independence, yeah. And it's almost as if, though, she can't imagine the audience at home and what they're going to be shouting at the telly. Now, of course, if you really believe in Scottish independence, frankly, you don't care. Just the same with Brexit. You want it and that's it. But for those they need to convince, you end up making yourself look quite foolish. Now, you're relatively more popular than your opponents, so fine. So you can win elections, but winning the referendum, which is what they exist for, is another matter. And I also think one of the mistakes they made was with this election, and it's kind of the point you made. I think if Nicola Sturgeon would have said, I'm ruling out a referendum in the lifetime of this parliament, let me get with COVID, I think they'd have got a huge majority. And given the kind of, you say shamelessness, given the some people might say she's very nimble, at some point towards the end of that parliament, you know, you get to polish that majority a bit. You get to say, look, the Scottish people gave me a huge majority. They know I'm a nationalist. Let's be honest. This represents, and because already they are doing that. So you'd have been able to do that with a majority. And also, let's be honest, they're not probably going to have a referendum in the next 2 years anyway, because they, purely for the reason they think they'd lose it, I think. If they thought they could win it in the next 2 years, they'd have it. I think they correctly actually assess that people are horrified at the thought of a referendum anytime soon, even people who agree with it. So why not just do that? Why not say, give me the lifetime of a parliament, I rule it out, whether you're Leave, Remain, yes or no, Labour or Tory, you know I'm the most competent leader in the country, in her opinion, give me that majority. And I think that would have solved... Now, of course, Alba, on the other flank, may have then been able to make some ground at their expense. So it's not an entirely, you know, it's not a ravine without kind of danger. But I just thought, if I was advising her, I'd have gone for that. But I realised that it's different for them. I mean, do you think that's right?
Well, I think the answer to why she couldn't do that was that it wouldn't have been acceptable to her party. The party exists on the basis of, you know, the referendum as soon as possible. And I think for her to have, I suspect, I don't know, I'm not versed enough in the ways of the SNP, I suspect that might have caused ructions within the party to rule it out for a parliament at a time when, you know, the party itself has got some fundamental splits and there are, you know, personalities vying for position. So I assume that's why she has to keep the thing on the front burner. I think you're right. I suspect that, you know, it'll be pushed down the line a little bit. You know, it's already been pushed to post-COVID before anything much happens on this, because the key thing, you know, which will put the pressure on the Westminster government will be if, you know, the percentage in favour of independence actually rises, you know, well above 55% for a sustained period of time, and there's any evidence that people actually want the referendum, you know, because the polls were showing before the election that even among, you know, significant proportion of people who would vote yes, they didn't think this was a priority that should be pushed for. And, you know, given the likely upheavals we're going to have with public spending and the rest over the next couple of years, you can understand why. You know, Labour is a major player in all of this because it's basically the thing that changed the game, you know, in the latter part of the referendum, and everybody thought it was initially kind of moving fairly comfortably towards a no vote, and it got tight towards the end, was because Labour lost a grip on its heartland in the west of Scotland, its own kind of Scottish red wall, if you like, you know, in the Glasgow and the, you know, North Lanarkshire, the places which West Dunbartonshire, where they voted yes in the referendum, which had previously, you know, been pretty tough areas for the SNP, and have now the places where they're, you know, arguably more entrenched than where they used to be strong. And so, you know, only Labour can ever beat the SNP in those areas. There's a very interesting by-election coming up on Thursday, which, you know, most people are assuming is going to be fairly comfortable for the SNP, and on likelihood it will be, in Adrian Schott's. But the history of by-elections taking, or any kind of election taking place in the kind of immediate wake of a big general election, is that you can sometimes get quirky results through low turnout or through just the reaction to the result which has taken place one way or another. There's still a fair number of Tory votes, which the SNP got just over 50% of the vote in on last week there. There's still a fair number of Tories who could be squeezed to vote Labour probably in that election. It may be a little bit closer than people are suspecting, but this is, you know, it's one of the big opportunities Labour has to get back into its heartland and, you know, have a, you know, a new message for, you know, people who it needs in Scotland, because after all, it's very unlikely there's going to be a Labour government unless there's quite a significant number of Labour MPs in Scotland.
Anas Sarwar's a big change for Scottish Labour. He's a charismatic, thoughtful, talented leader, arguably more talented than Sturgeon, arguably more likable. I mean, I've never seen... I'm not sure if you watched them all. I think I watched every Scottish leaders debate this time, and I watched the Welsh leaders debate, and being trying to... And it's very hard to watch it neutrally if you've worked in politics, or, you know, everyone has politics. But what shocked me was I thought Anas Sarwar won every debate. I thought he was the most talented. I thought he resonated more with public opinion. Now, his outcome should be judged on what Labour would have done under Richard Leonard, not necessarily what happened last time. But nevertheless, it shows how hard it is for him, as someone who really cut through, to shift. A similar problem for Keir Starmer is you have these leaders that by any measure are more talented and acceptable to the public than their predecessors, yet they've struggled to shift the dial. Now, obviously, Anas Sarwar only had about 5 or 6 weeks to try and make an impact against, by far the most popular politician in Scotland, one of the most popular politicians in the UK, so it's going to be hard. But what are the implications for him, do you think? Do you think he can come away and say, I made a positive impact and that I need to carry on doing what I'm doing? Or does he need to change his messaging in the wake of that result?
I'm ashamed to admit I didn't see any of the Scottish leaders' debates.
I don't think that's something to be ashamed of.
But, you know, clearly all the kind of genuinely objective commentators seem to think that he had performed well and, you know, inverted commas, had won them. You know, it's very early for him. I think the result, as it turned out, was a lot better than it could have been. You know, Labour was looking at going down towards the mid-teens if it wasn't careful in terms of its share of the vote, and probably losing all its constituency seats, and held on well to two of them. And clearly came out, you know, as you say, he's clearly someone who's you know, got the capacity to get a message across in a way that perhaps Scottish Labour hasn't done before. I think, you know, his Labour's the third party in Scotland, so it's going to be, you know, hard for him to kind of get much of a hearing while all this debate is going on between Sturgeon and Johnson over the referendum and so on. But I think, you know, he's smart enough to kind of play the long game here. And when we get to, you know, by-elections, and so the by-election on Thursday would be an interesting indicator on this, and future by-elections, then that might be local elections next year will be a good opportunity for Labour to make some steady progress in trying to reverse, you know, what's been a pretty traumatic 5 years, 6 years for them.
Also, what he has is, let's say there is a referendum in the next 5 to 10 years, or 3 to 5 years, having him as a leading light of a Remain campaign in Scotland does shift things a bit. You know, I get the sense that he's able to appeal to people who would waver and keep them on side, probably in a way that very few politicians can. And that makes him a crucial figure.
Perhaps. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And these problems arguably all started when, you know, in the previous referendum campaign, when the SNP was incredibly successful at painting Labour into a corner as playing along the Tory-led no campaign with the Better Together last time. You know, completely unfair allegation, but you know, probably the kind of root cause of the you know, the swings in the Glasgow area, for example, and the hatred of the Tories reflecting itself in that movement to the SNP, which we've seen since. So I think, yes, you're right. So, you know, from what I've seen of him, I think he'll be a very effective advocate for the cause. And it's very important that Labour is seen as, you know, a leading non-Tory voice in that. And then we don't get a situation which on the face of it might be more likely, as things are at the moment. This is an SNP versus Tory argument.
There were more explicitly positive outcomes for Labour. Andy Burnham having a phenomenal result. And in Wales, and one thing that binds Scotland, England and Wales together is voters in all of those countries effectively voted for the party of government that had gotten through this crisis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Labour's been very, very dogged in Wales through, you know, all the six elections. I think it has been to the Welsh Assembly, the Senedd. Over that period, it's normally come out with pretty much the same result. It's never quite managed to get over into the technical majority of 31 seats, but it's got 30 seats now three times. And, you know, most of us looking at it, I think, said, well, Labour's pretty much on the back foot here because you've got these four seats in North East Wales, which the Tories gained in the Westminster election 2019 and one in South Wales. The Welsh system is less proportional. So if, you know, if you Labour lost those seats or most of them, it wouldn't have got them back from the list on the whole. And they looked very vulnerable on the face of it, but actually Labour won most of them, lost one of them, but won the rest of them reasonably comfortably, won the seat back from Plaid Cymru in Rhondda, which has given them the position they are. So, you know, it's a really right at the top end, I think, of the expectations, because it was the same situation which, you know, was facing Labour in much of England, that you had a big UKIP vote from the 2016 election, which all the polls indicated was going to go en masse to the Tories, and which would have taken out a lot of those seats. But, you know, Labour fought that off, and, you know, very, very creditable result from their point of view. And as you say, I think there is a, you know, the Welsh Assembly was, you know, squeaked through its referendum in 1998 or 1997 or whenever it was. You know, there wasn't a huge kind of public clamour behind it. I think it is now kind of establishing itself, and you've got these, you know, more of a push for, you know, even more powers. You know, I think part of the general trend with the, you know, the high profile mayors now, you've got Andy Burnham, Steve Rotherham, who are national figures, no doubt at all. Tracy Brabin is going to become one of those as well. And it's gradually kind of shifting the focus of our politics, I think, to, you know, so that we have more consciousness of the powers of devolution and the voices from individual parts of the country. And I think the Senedd is going to be a big benefit. He's going to benefit from that.
We talk a lot about Labour heartlands and about the effect of constitutional questions on them, losing ground to the SNP in the wake of the 2014 referendum, losing the so-called red wall to the Tories over Leave. Wales voted Leave, and yet it hasn't turned its back on Labour. Why is that?
Well, very good question. I mean, I think if you look demographically at the South Wales valleys, they've got a lot of similarities with, you know, County Durham and places like that. But it seems that what, you know, while the Labour vote has over the years declined there, as it has in you know, other, you know, major ex-coal fields like South Yorkshire and so on, what hasn't happened there is that it's gone to the Tories in any big way. And that's partly, I guess, because people do have, you know, people who, for whatever reason, are disaffected with Labour, have got the choice of Plaid as a more, certainly in assembly elections, tended to be a more obvious choice. But also, and these things are unmeasurable, it may just be that the sort of opprobrium of the Tories culturally in much of Wales still lives on in a way that it doesn't in the rest of the country. Now, it'd be very complacent from Labour's point of view to think that that would necessarily continue indefinitely. But, you know, it's one of the great joys of you know, studying elections and following elections, is that these kind of unmeasurable factors are still at play in different parts of the country. And you can't just, you know, turn everything into a spreadsheet or a model and think it's all going to behave the same way in every part of the country based on how many working class people or how many young people you've got or whatever. You know, there are things, you know, which you best described as political culture, which are, and community effects, incredibly important. You know, the fact that, you know, people's tend to live with their relatives and friends and in areas which they, you know, where they feel happiest and most comfortable. And so that creates, you know, magnifies all of these effects, that these things are big dynamics in election results. And I think Wales is a great example of that. You know, it behaves differently. You know, it's had its own kind of red wall trend in the opposite sense, in that Cardiff is now a huge Labour, or much of Cardiff is now a huge Labour stronghold, whereas it used to be, if anything, Tory leaning, you know, middle class city. And probably the Welsh Assembly has contributed to that, because a lot of people in Cardiff work there. But we haven't seen that red wall effect, certainly not in South Wales. You arguably you have in, you know, Wrexham and so on, but you haven't seen the rise of the Tories, and certainly not the kind of enthusiasm for Johnson that you've seen in similar places in England.
And what of the Welsh national question then? As you say, the referendum to establish a Welsh Assembly, and it's its inception was different. It had different powers to the Scottish Parliament. There was more of a clamour in Scotland for self-representation, for a parliament of sorts, and for those powers to be there. Now, obviously, Wales and Scotland have different relationships with themselves, with England, with the rest of the UK. Welsh nationalism seems to be more benign. There seems to be just less appetite for it. Why is that?
I don't know. For years and years, you know, the idea of Welsh independence, you know, wasn't even kind of advocated very seriously by the Welsh nationalists. You know, I'm sure there, you know, there were probably amongst their number many of them who would have aspired to that, but it was almost a kind of joke idea. And in polls, it was like single figures who would support it. And then you've had these really kind of quite extraordinary surveys recently, which have, and to be honest, I can't remember the precise wording of them, it suggested there's like 30 or 40% of people, and particularly strong amongst young people, who like the idea of Wales being an independent country. Whether that actually means when it comes down to it, you know, all the paraphernalia that will come with the kind of independence that the Scottish nationalists want, who knows, not been really tested. But what we didn't see in last week's election is any sign of that playing out, as far as I can see. I mean, the Plaid Cymru vote share, I think, from what I can remember, was very, very slightly down. You know, they lost one of their police and crime commissioner posts in North Wales. A couple of the seats where, you know, they have aspirations to win from Labour, Llanelli, quite a big swing in Labour's favour. So there's no evidence that it's playing out in support for Plaid Cymru, you know, who've got a long established association with, you know, most of their support coming from Welsh speaking areas and support for the language and so on, and certain middle class parts in the Cardiff area have voted for them as well. But I think it seems to me we're a much, it'd be foolish to kind of write off the idea that like, this might grow over the years, but we're at very much more of an embryo stage to this process, I think, here than in Scotland.
What of the Greens then across Britain? There's been talk of a Green surge. Obviously, it's relative. But is it just that with the Greens, if people don't feel that Labour is a viable option, they think, well, I can have a bit of a protest vote. And if Labour becomes more likely to form a government, those voters basically effectively come on side? Or is something else happening?
It's obviously true to say that, you know, green politics and the politics of climate change and all the rest are becoming much more kind of part of the normality of our lives, and people are accepting many of the, policy changes, the changes to their lifestyles, the changes to their diet and the rest of it, which, you know, are being demanded from this process. And so to that extent, they're kind of, you know, probably, you know, rather more central to the political argument than they've been in the past. It looks to me from the outside also as though they're, as a party, they're much more effective organising. You know, they're getting more and more candidates standing. They've clearly benefited also from the demise of the Liberal Democrats as a national force, because, you know, they're, you know, in individual areas. I mean, the norm in the local elections, the pattern, it seemed to me, across the piece was that where you had, you know, the standard four parties standing, Labour, Lib Dem, Tory and Green, the Greens, unless it was an area where the Lib Dems had a particular focus of organisation or a tradition, the Greens were normally coming out ahead. And there's been some polls where they've been, you know, ahead of the Lib Dems in national vote share as well. There are also clearly some areas where the Lib Dems and Greens are working together, and there's clearly an overlap in kind of political philosophy between them. They're standing aside for each other to try and maximise their representation. And they had some spectacular successes. You know, they won a number of seats, some big clusters. They had a big comeback on Bristol Council, where they'd been kind of squeezed out by tactical voting for Labour in the council elections 4 years ago. Lots of seats which they won. And back in 2019, again, in the elections, just before the Euro elections there, they had sort of picked up seats in very unlikely places. Not always, you know, we shouldn't assume always that these are people who are voting Green for ideological reasons. You know, a lot of the places where, you know, there's one particular ward in Huddersfield, for example, which has elected Green councillors for about 20 years. There's another one in Leeds. These are relatively working class places. They're not places which are, you know, got lots of what people would normally think of as, you know, typical Green voters. So an element of it is also just the normal kind of Lib Dem like community activism and just being pavement politics and so on. But, you know, I would expect that we're going to see that trend grow. We may see them becoming, you know, serious players in parliamentary elections in certain areas. It's clearly one of the dangers for Labour. You know, individual seats where they've relied on Green tactical voting for their success in the last few years, where that may not be relied upon if the Greens become viable in their own right. So I think it definitely looks to me like, you know, and I think one of the key aspects to this is the relationship with the Lib Dems and whether there's kind of overt cooperation between them, the extent to which they kind of feed off, as I say, the national decline of the Lib Dems.
What's incredible, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I think it makes the point. I hadn't even thought about asking you about the Lib Dems. They're just totally kind of slipped my mind. I thought, well, we've got to talk about London, Scotland, Wales, you know, all these things. I didn't even think of the Lib Dems. I mean, I guess that tells its own story.
Yeah, I mean, if I was a Lib Dem looking objectively at these results, I'd actually not be too unhappy. You know, because clearly the 2019 election on all sorts of levels was a complete and utter disaster for them. You know, they went into the coalition with all the problems which that caused for them with left of centre voters. They then took a decision over Brexit, you know, directed by their beliefs as a party, certainly, but it seemed to me there was a gaping opportunity when Labour elected Jeremy Corbyn as leader for a centrist, non-Tory alternative to Labour to attract some of those votes. But the Lib Dems took a decision to take a more extreme position on Brexit and the referendum and to define themselves by that. Quite legitimate, you know, if that's what they wanted to do, that's fine. But it has left them post-Brexit in quite a difficult position. But having said that, their strength has always been their local organisation. There's still a fair number of councils up and down the country which they control. And looking at individual results, what was striking to me in this election was that, yes, they had a few losses, you know, probably more to the Tories than anybody else in a few places, but they were also popping up and gaining seats, you know, in quite unlikely areas. You know, a number of Labour's worst results in Sunderland, which you wouldn't have thought of as a great Lib Dem area, were losses to the Lib Dems, one assumes, because of local factors and the local organisation they have there. They won a couple of seats, I think, in Barnsley, you know, Red Wally type areas, which is a phenomenon we haven't seen on great scale for a while of people who don't want to vote Labour, but actually choosing the Lib Dems as an alternative. I think it's a long way back for them to become a national force for them. And, you know, the other side of that, symbolically, one of the most extraordinary results, it seemed to me, of the whole election was the Tories got a majority in Cornwall, which used to be the, you know, the great Lib Dem centre. I think, you know, once heard somebody say that a quarter of all Lib Dem members at one point lived in Cornwall. You know, big losses by them. So their southwest base, you know, with the exception of one or two untypical places like Bath and Cheltenham, has pretty much gone for them in national terms. They've got some local government base still, but that is now becoming much more dominant for the Tories. But their ability to win seats off the back of their local presence and local organisation is sustaining them still. And there's always the possibility that some, you know, probably most likely a parliamentary by-election somewhere, something will give them a bit more of a profile.
What's been great about this, Greg, is there's positives for all parties. No matter who people listen to, who they support, they'll listen to this. Oh, actually, I feel good about the Lib Dems and positives of the SNP and for Labour.
I'm not sure there's much you could say in favour of reform, but yeah.
No, I mean, again.
Or yeah. Alba.
No. But for the major parties,
yeah.
Comfort somewhere for all of them. Greg, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
No problem. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Greg Cook, do you feel like a prime minister? Did you feel like you were at the heart of Downing Street being told what's really going on out there in the country? I did, listening back to it. I thought, this is absolutely great. And Greg's knowledge and expertise really are unrivaled and unparalleled. And he's very modest at times in that interview. He is absolutely on top of the detail. And the really interesting thing I thought was, talking about, I'm not even sure you can call it the vaccine bounce or whatever, but just the general sense that people have, well, I guess there's two things. One, people have stuck with, in every nation of the UK that had elections, stuck with a government that led them through the crisis. So that's true in Wales, in Scotland and in England. If you take the results at an England level. But what's so there's that. But then there's also just this sense that, the vaccine thing's going well. So that's helping the Conservatives. And I was really I just always like it when, you know, you got a bit of a pet theory and someone goes, I don't think that's going to play out. So something that I've thought might happen is after all this, and I obviously talked about this with Greg, after all this, will public opinion change? Will that sense of outrage be delayed? And once we're through basically survival mode, will people look back and will opinion change? And partly why I thought that was Iraq was at the time, obviously the polling was split and it was volatile, but at times in the lead up to Iraq and during it, people were in favour of it. And there was the so-called Baghdad bounce, for want of a better phrase. Obviously in time, opinion has hardened as details have emerged. And of course, what happened in Iraq after the war has been arguably a large part of that, but about the way that both Labour and the Conservatives talked about Iraq afterwards. And I just wondered with this, whether a similar thing would happen, would that you would have Labour, of course, holding the government to account. But if the Conservative ranks split when details emerge and they say, actually, I told the Health Secretary or the Prime Minister, I thought that was a bad idea. And then a new narrative evolves that has people on both sides attacking that decision. Maybe then you end up in a situation where opinion shifts. Now, I didn't quite put it like that to Greg, but it was interesting that he didn't think that that was going to be the case and that actually people's opinion now may not shift. Obviously, if there are new twists and turns and things get worse, then opinion may shift in that way. But this kind of pet theory of mine that there's a sense of judgment deferred perhaps is, I say perhaps, it sounds like it's almost certainly incorrect, but let's see. So I really enjoyed that because I thought, I think I've perhaps I've been overthinking where public opinion might go after all this. But we shall see. Don't forget to email the show with your funny stories, particularly if they're embarrassing and toe-curling like Chris's was about falling asleep in front of Theresa May, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Go to mattford.com/live. Those gigs are only a week or so away. I can't wait to be back on stage with the show, particularly with the guests I have, particularly at the venue, the Garrick and the Vaudeville. And of course, to be in front of a political party audience again, the best audience in global showbiz. So I can't wait to see you all there. Subscribe to British Scandal and have a great weekend. Thank you to Greg Cook for a fantastic briefing. And I'll see you next week. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.